I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 177 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. This week's guest is one quarter of the original 10cc and one half of the inventive music and video-making duo Godley and Cream, Kevin Godley. Godley spoke from his home in rural Ireland, where he is planning to direct a movie about Orson Welles. In December, he joined former bandmate Graham Gouldman's version of 10cc on stage in London to sing the prescient ballad Old Wild Men. They also played a more recent Godley and Gouldman song, BeautifulLoser.com.
Now she's just another loser.
At age 79, Godley's baritone and falsetto still sound amazing. Godley and Gouldman, who appeared on Caro Pop last November, go back to primary school together in the Manchester, England area. They also were in the band The Mockingbirds and had other connections before 10cc was formed. Godley and Lal Cream met in art college in Manchester and became partners in songwriting and other creative endeavors. The latter included the invention of the gizmo, a device that attaches to an electric guitar to make a kind of swirling sound. It's featured on Old Wild Men, in fact, and would play a role in Godley and Cream's departure from 10cc. In the late 60s and early 70s, the four future 10cc members wrote and recorded bubblegum singles for hire. One early Godley and Cream song, There Ain't No Umbo Po, came out in 1970 under the name Crazy Elephant, with Godley singing lead. Godley's thumping drumming drove the 1970 massive earworm and fluke hit Neanderthal Man, for which Godley, Cream, and Stewart billed themselves as Hot Legs. Godley tells of the accidental way they captured that song's odd sound. 10cc debuted with the 1972 doo-wop parody single Donna, written by Godley and Cream. It appears on 10cc's self-titled 1973 album. Although Godley and Cream dominated early on, this was a band with four strong songwriters and singers, as Stewart and Gouldman paired off as well. Godley, who has 10cc's most angelic voice and broadest range, describes the band's process for choosing who would sing what. The classic lineup made four albums together. 1974's Sheet Music features Godley and Cream's Somewhere in Hollywood, highlighted by Godley's beautiful singing and more scene shifts than your average movie. The star is gonna be born. 1975's The Original Soundtrack kicks off with an even more epic Godley and Cream composition, One Night in Paris. Given its multiple sections, massive harmonies, and operatic overtones, some have wondered whether Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, which came out 7 months later, was inspired by it. Godley has thoughts. The original soundtrack also includes the band's biggest hit, the hypnotic I'm Not in Love, written by Stewart and Gouldman, sung by Stewart, and conceived brilliantly by the four of them in the studio. But from Godley's perspective, the popularity of this towering achievement had unintended consequences. After making the relatively disjointed How Dare You from 1976, 10cc was preparing to record its fifth album when the reaction to one new song, which Godley names here, blew everything up. Godley takes us through those early and prime 10cc years, and in part two of this conversation, coming next week, we move on to Godley and Cream post-split as they innovate in music and groundbreaking videos. The theme throughout this conversation is the never-ending drive for art, creativity, and keeping everything fresh, even at the expense of commercial prospects. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Kevin Godley.
Working on any old piece of shit for experience and the hell of it. Fueled by cigarettes and curry, hashish, lack of sleep and worry. The churned out crap for pocket money.
So are you still shooting videos?
Yeah, I mean, this was one I shot a while ago, but they just wanted another version of it, so I just sent it. Yeah, I do them occasionally, but there seems to be less call for them because labels and management and so on have discovered AI,
no.
Which means they don't have to pay anybody, you know, and deal with egos and shoots and crews and all that nonsense.
I don't want to see AI videos. That's horrible.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some artists working in that medium that are making interesting things. But the only good ones that I've seen seem to make strange, peculiar creatures. But nevertheless, they're interesting. It's one of those things that are happening that I imagine will find a level. At least I hope it does and doesn't replace human beings.
Right. Yeah, we need the musicians and the writers both to be able to keep doing what they do without being replaced by robots.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Hey, guys, we've got $50 million. Let's make a new Marlon Brando movie. You know, yeah. Possible.
I read somewhere that you were working on a movie about Orson Welles in Ireland.
That's right. I've written a screenplay about Orson Welles in Ireland. Not many people know he spent time here. But he did. In 1931, he went on what could best be described as a gap year to sail around the world, the insistence of his mother, who was having a bit of a fling with a local doctor. So he was sent away on a gap year. But on a whim, he disembarked in Galway and hired a donkey and cart and rode around the countryside, the West Country, painting, and spent some time there, ended up in Dublin. Sort of conned his way into the Gate Theatre and got himself a part, his first professional role, and was a huge hit.
So it's this kind of unknown formative year for Orson Welles then?
The film itself, the story begins on the last night of his life, but he's remembering his first ever moment of glory, if you like, where he went on stage and wowed an audience for the first time. And he was on the Merv Griffin show on the last night of his life, and he talks a little bit about it. But so it's everything is very encapsulated into that particular time frame. But it was very strange. While I was researching him and reading all the books about him, I've always been a fan of his work anyway, but learning about him and this period in his life was incredibly informative and very... I actually felt like him when I was writing it. I felt like... And I met a friend of mine who's also a filmmaker who owns a pair of his boots.
Wow. Are you looking to direct this yourself?
But what a guy. Yeah. I have two scripts. One I have co-written with a friend of mine, and the other that I wrote on my own, which is the Wells Project. But yeah, I would like to direct.
What's the other one?
What I really want to do is direct. Everybody says that. The other one is about the possible future of television. The horrible possible future of television.
What gets more horrible than it is?
Oh, probably nothing. But the way I've approached it is more horrible. It's more revealing. It's the sort of, it's a meeting about a production company who's sort of gone down in the ratings, and they're looking for something even more awful than what they do already to get their audience back. I shall say no more.
I was going to say, what is it? All right. I'll have to read the script or see, better yet, see the movie when you make it. And you know, it's funny because like I talked to Graham Gouldman and I was like, oh, it'd be really great to talk to Kevin Godley. And I finally reached out and then I saw that you actually had a new song with Graham. The first one, what, in like 19 years, Don't Want to Go to Heaven. So how did that come about?
Yeah.
How do you and he work together? Like what's the process of creating a song like that?
Sporadically. Well, this one was very, it was kind of simple in a way. The reason we wrote it was, let me just backtrack and see why. They were releasing I'm Not in Love to celebrate the 50th anniversary of that song and right. The album it was part of. And we thought, oh, well, maybe we could write a new B-side for it. It would be fun to do, and we haven't written together for a while, but the label said, no, let's leave the B-side as it was. I think it's a Godley and Cream track called Good News. But if you want to do something new, we'll release it as part of the package that's going out around about the same time. And I had something that I'd been working on. I got two or three things, and I played them to Graham, and he thought that this one was really interesting. So he came over to our place, and we finished it. Well, we finished writing the basics and part of the vocal. Then he went home. I did a bit more work, sent what I'd done to him. He did some more work on it in his home studio, sent it back to me. So using modern technology, we were bouncing the results backwards and forwards, and then we just had it mixed and mastered. End of story. It was it's possible to do that these days.
Sure. Were
and
you two working on the lyrics?
It's with somebody you know, so.
Absolutely.
No,
were you,
not
Were you
not
working
really
on the lyrics and the music the together,
lyrics,
or did one of you do more of one or the other?
The lyrics, the music more than the lyrics. The lyrics were pretty much written. I'd
You'd
written the
them.
Lyrics.
Right.
But the chords weren't quite there, and the musicality of it wasn't quite there. And the sounds and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
So yeah, you wrote with Graham when you had your GG06 songs, and I counted three songs that the two of you co-wrote in 10cc. You did the Sacroiliac, Channel Swimmer, and Iceberg. So in general, what's the process?
The weird thing about that, well, back then the process, because there was a lack of technology, we'd sit in a room and we'd strum guitars and sing, you know, and that was it, face to face, in you know, authentic reality. But now it's, I think part of the thing is, if you're working with somebody you know, the process tends to disappear and you use whatever you have to hand and you react to whatever is on the page and whatever's been recorded. So there was a little time spent together here in Dublin where we polished the basics of what we had. Did some more recording, but I only had a day with Graham, and then he went back to England. I did a bit more, then sent what I'd done to Graham, and he recorded bass, recorded some backing vocals, and recorded some more lead guitar, and then sent it back to me. So it was a sort of bouncing backwards and forwards
right.
procedure more than anything else, but it didn't make any difference that we weren't face-to-face.
And you two have known each other for so long. I mean, you've been you knew each other for many years before you were even in 10cc. You like grew up together.
That's right. I'd forgotten that, but we were at what's known as primary school together when we were kids.
Yeah, and then you were in the Mockingbirds with him also.
Yep, Mockingbirds. Absolutely. It was a small group of people around where we lived who were in bands, but we kept crossing paths over the years, and Graham, when Law Cream and I started writing songs seriously, he became our mentor, and we got to record demos at his house, his parents' house, on a sort of Revox two-track, which was great fun. So, you know, he sort of gave us a leg up and helped us understand what this was really all about.
When you started in music, were you thinking of yourself more as a musician, like a drummer, or a singer, or a songwriter, or did you plan on all three of those things?
I don't remember thinking at all. It was more of an instinct. One thing I've learned over the years, personally, whatever it is that I'm doing, creatively, is that too much thought can kill something. If it feels like you're sort of heading in the right direction with whatever it is you're doing, just keep going. So I, you know, at the time we started writing, we were both at art college. We were on a different tack, learning to be graphic designers and stuff, probably because our parents wanted us to have, in inverted commas, a proper job.
Right.
You know, as opposed to being artists. But, you know, weekends we get together and sort of write crazy ideas and songs and ideas for shows and stay up all night and so on and so forth. But the only thought part of it was sort of when you've got a certain way into a project and you needed to polish it, then you start thinking. But thought isn't, or not traditional thinking, not analysis, that doesn't come into it much, at least not for me.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you guys are known as...
Does that make sense?
It does. And at the same time, you're known as a pretty cerebral sort of writers. And, you know, there's like a lot of kind of smart, clever stuff going on in a lot of your music, but it's sort of using instinct to get to that place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, who knows where all this stuff comes from anyway, but you've just got to let it in. And if you start thinking, oh, you can't say that, and what can I say that any better? And should that be a the or an ah? If you get into that mode too early, you're not allowing it to breathe. You have to let it come to life before you can fuck it up. You know what I mean?
At what point did you start drumming? And what was it that drew you to that instrument?
Well, before that, I was in a very short-lived band called Group 17. I have no idea why it was called Group 17. But I was the bass player, and I was a hopeless. I didn't even have a bass. I was playing bass on a six-string guitar.
Mm.
But I was crap. And my next-door neighbor, Jeffrey, his father was the local councillor, so they were quite well off. And he got a drum kit for his birthday. He must have been about, I don't know, 15 or something like that. And he was, sorry, Jeffrey, but he was the worst drummer you'd ever heard of. He would, you know, he would go into a roll and come out backwards, playing the beat backwards and all sorts of terrible stuff, with a big grin on his face as if to say, wasn't that fabulous? But I eventually persuaded him to let me sit down behind the kit and have a go myself. And I found that I had that sort of, you know, when people say, oh, playing the drums, it's mental because, you know, you're doing four different things at the same time. You're not. You're actually doing four parts of the same thing at the same time. And I had that facility instantly. The right foot could do the bass drum. The left hand could do the drums and the right hand could do the cymbals, and it was a machine, you know. I had that at a very simple level right away.
Mm.
And it also meant I could sit at the back and be part of the engine room as opposed to up at the front doing silly dancing and playing bass badly.
And did you always like singing as well?
Yeah, but I never kind of saw myself as a singer. Until much later. I was a shower singer.
Yeah, it seems like throughout, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but I was going to say throughout 10cc and then Godly and Cream, your vocals became more and more prominent. You know, like you really were like the lead singer of Godly and Cream, and then 10cc, you all kind of were trading off a little bit more.
The thing about 10cc was when it came to vocals, I mean, we were all singers, but if we just completed recording a track and it was lead vocal time, each of us would go into the studio and try it out, audition for the other three.
Really?
If you like. Which was, that is exactly what would happen because, you know, what we were trying to do was find the best voice for this track. So off Lol would go and he'd have a go and then we'd hold up a sign saying next. And then Graham would go in or Eric would go in. And we, you know, we went through all four of us until we found someone who could master this particular song. It was that simple. But it was somewhat different with Godly and Cream. I think Lol was kind of the lead singer of 10cc to a degree. He was one of the front men. But he tired of it. After a while, by the time we were sort of well into Godly and Cream music, and I had a bigger range, and so I gradually, not because I desired it particularly, but I found I could do the stuff we were writing better than Lol could, so I kind of did more vocals than he did.
Interesting, yeah, because you have like your regular I mean, I'm not good on this technical stuff, but, you know, your regular chest voice that has a lot of grit to it, and then this just wide-ranging falsetto that just gets really high and is very sweet. And so, yeah, you have like a ton of range, you know, more than anyone else in that band. So, and that's certainly more prominent in, again, those solo records. I mean, not solo records, the Godly and Cream records.
Thank you.
How many songs did you and Lal Cream write together before 10cc even started?
I think when we were at art school, we probably wrote three or four, not that many songs. And then, of course, after Hot Legs existed and we'd had a hit record with this bizarre thing, Neanderthal Man,
right,
in the UK. I think that was 1969 or 70 or something. We recorded an album. And some of the songs on that were just Godly and Cream songs. Some were also with Eric, as I recall. So, you know, by the time 10cc came around, we were sort of an established writing partnership. We knew how to write songs, whether they were good or bad.
Well, and didn't you write a whole bunch for the Cassinets and Cats? Like, you know, There Ain't No Umbopo and all those songs?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. That was an embarrassing part of our early years. Well, I mean, it was, you have to understand that when Strawberry Studios came into being in Stockport, outside Manchester, it was probably the first professional standard recording studio in that neck of the woods, in the north of England. Because most artists who were doing anything and doing any good had sort of legged it down to London to record, because that's where the industry lived. So we were left with, what was that Woody Allen film that was about radio? Was it Radio Days?
Radio Days, yeah.
With all sorts of strange acts in it. It was, you know, full of odd acts and ventriloquists and comedians. We were left with that. And people like that started to sort of book time in the studios, and we sort of became the house producers. And we did exactly that. We found ourselves writing for comedians and producing ventriloquists. But the biggest bunch of sessions that came in the early days were indeed the Cassinets Cats.
Graham had a contract with them, I think, in New York, and then he sort of started, you know, working with you on those, right? Your sort of bubblegum.
I think what happened is he became a part. That's right. He became a partner at Strawberry Studios. So they collectively figured out that maybe they could save some money and get some work into Strawberry if we actually performed the sessions at Strawberry as opposed to doing it in New York.
Right.
So that's pretty much what happened. There was a guy who sort of oversaw the sessions called Richie Cordell. I think he wrote a song called Moni Moni.
Right.
I don't remember it. His real name was Richie Rosenblatt. Yeah, that's right. His real name was Richie Rosenblatt. And he had pickled onions all day. Mm. And he was sort of like the executive producer of the sessions. But yeah, we wrote stuff. It wasn't what we wanted to do at the time, but we thought, fuck it, let's learn our chops here and now by doing these bizarre pretend to be other bands sessions.
Right, and coming up with something like There Ain't No Umbopo, which is like, Umbopo, what the heck is that?
I don't know, fuck knows. a river, maybe?
And then you wrote about this years later. I think this is one of your GG06 songs, right? Son of Man, where you wrote, working on any old piece of shit for experience and the hell of it, fueled by cigarettes and curry, hashish, lack of sleep and worry, they churned out crap for pocket money.
Yeah.
It's like your little history of 10cc there.
Well, that song is, it's sort of an audible documentary that lasts a short amount of time. But yeah, that's exactly what it was about. Exactly. Well spotted.
And then Hot Legs. So you got to know Eric because Eric was at Strawberry, right? And the other three of you already knew each other. And then I guess Graham was maybe away, and the three of you, you Lal and Eric, did the Hot Legs stuff, including Neanderthal Man, which I'd heard.
Yeah,
it was like what, like you were sort of like testing out the drum sound and just sort of sang along without really being that close to the microphones.
Yeah, when Strawberry opened, it was like a small studio. I think it was a 4-track studio, but you know, Eric couldn't do everything. He could, you know, he was obviously hugely instrumental in setting up the technology and so on and so forth. But he got me and Lolin to play stuff while he set up microphones and tested everything. One of the tests was how to make a drum kit. So he had me banging away for a long time, you know, sometimes multi-tracking a drum kit, but a Lol would sit on the floor opposite me, about 4 or 5 feet away, just sort of strumming this mad ditty. Didn't really know what the hell it was, because I was hammering away. But it was there on the microphone. It was there. It was actually in the recording. So we started working on it, because, again, it was a way to test the desk's capability. But what happened is, you know, nobody quite knew what they were doing, I don't think, in those days. So we spent a day messing around with it, went home, and came back the next day. But unfortunately, there was a session in overnight, and they used that piece of tape that we'd been working on as an echo tape and wiped it. So we had to start all over again. But at least we discovered something, and we knew what it consisted of, so we recorded it better. So both aspects of doing it was instructive, if that makes any sense.
So Lal playing guitar and singing, was he mic'd, or was that just coming over the drum mics?
It was just coming over the drum mics.
So even when you re-recorded it, you're like, let's stick with that approach.
No, we probably did it properly, but we pulled it back to make it sound as if it was just coming over the drum mic.
Because you just liked how it sounded. It's a cool sound. I mean, and certainly with, you know, a title like Neanderthal Man, that kind of, it has this kind of prehistoric rock and roll thing going on.
Well, it taught us something. I mean, it's always stuck with me that sometimes accidents happen in a recording studio, and sometimes those are the best things, the things you don't anticipate.
And you and Lal really wrote most of that debut album, including Donna, which was, you know, sort of the fluke first hit. How did you two work together at that point?
Oh, very traditionally. I don't play an instrument, okay? So I would sit opposite Lal, and he would have a stinky old acoustic guitar, and he would strum, and I would react to what he was strumming. We worked like any sort of guitar-based songwriting partnership, I think. I had a notebook and a pen, he had a guitar, and off we would go, except for this track. This was a departure. Neanderthal Man was a departure. It was the first time that we'd written on tape, I think, reacting to sound instead of something that was already partially written. So that was quite interesting. The stupid thing, though, and I think this probably counts for most people who are starting off writing songs and recording them, is that when we came to do the Hot Legs album, we thought, oh, okay, Neanderthal Man was a hit, but really it was a piece of shit. We want music to sound like the Beatles. We want music to sound like the Beach Boys. That's proper music.
Mm.
I think it's true that all new writers, recording people, they have an image or a sense of what good music is, and they can't help themselves by sort of, even if it's self-conscious or even if it's semi-conscious, subconscious, is to emulate some of their heroes. That goes into what you do. It's inevitable.
I think everyone starts like that, basically, including the Beatles.
Yeah. That's right, but it was really silly, because we made an album that sounded a bit like what we thought sounded like the Beatles, but the most original piece on it was Neanderthal Man. Sure, you couldn't really call it a song. Sure, it had a very repetitious chorus, and sure, it was the weirdest thing you'd ever heard. But it was more original than anything else on there. The rest kind of showed our budding abilities to write, but not that basic awareness that we should be looking to innovate, and we had and didn't know it.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's popular anti-hero IPA combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And with the weather heating up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. The four of you backed Neil Sedaka on a record, and then you started recording as 10cc with Donna as the first single, you know, even though I might have been a B-side at first. Like, what was the leap from that Hot Legs record to the first 10cc record? Because the first 10cc record obviously is better, right?
Yeah. It was Neil, actually, Neil Sedaka. It was during those sessions, probably the second album, that he actually said to us, don't forget, we were the house band of Strawberry. We were the house producers of Strawberry. And enjoying it. He said, you guys are great playing together. Why don't you form a band? And we thought, what? And four light bulbs went on above our heads. It was like we'd never even considered it until he said it. And then we thought, okay, when we finish this record, let's try something. Which we did. We recorded a song called Waterfall, if I remember correctly, which we submitted to Apple. Not the current Apple, but Apple, owned by the Beatles. And they knocked it back. So we had to write a B-side because we were going to present it elsewhere. And the B-side was Donna. And that got flipped once Jonathan King signed us to his label. And everything from that point was all about the group, I guess. So we never set out to become a group at that point. Someone suggested it and we took notice and off we went.
So was it sort of natural that you and Lal were a songwriting team, so Eric and Graham would also be a songwriting team?
Yeah, pretty much. From the off, it became a little bit more hybridized after that point, but initially it was two very distinct writing partnerships, yes.
Yeah, because I know Graham has credits on, you know, that record too with the two of you. I think Rubber Bullets. Yeah. He's, you know.
Oh yeah, so. Yeah. Occasionally, if we were stuck, we'd go to the others, and either one or both of them would throw something at it that made a difference. Sure.
And then Sheep Music, the second album, it's interesting, and I sort of like, I don't know if it's because I have a mathematical mind on top of my, you know, English major mind, but I remember looking at it and noticing, it's like, okay, there are four Godly Cream songs and two Stuart Gulman songs, and then each of you writes a song with the other members. So there are four other ones where there's one with you and Graham, and one with you and Eric, and then one with Lal and Graham, and one with Lal and Eric. And I don't know whether you did that on purpose or what, but it's also a great record, so it worked.
Well, it was like wife swapping at the beginning. It was like, I don't know if I fancy you as a songwriting partner. It was a bit like that. We were a bit wary of doing it, but it had to be done because we were in the band together, and why the fuck not? So, but it works. You got a different kind of song when you change partner, because you were both reacting in a different way. Your role in the creative process changed to accommodate somebody new. And it was great fun, actually. Writing with Graham was different to writing with Eric, and they were both different to writing with Law.
Yeah, Oh Effendi, the one you wrote with Eric, I mean, that's a song that it doesn't sound 50 years old in terms of the topic.
I don't think I'd write it in the same way, though. a thing where there's loads of things in all the different albums that you wouldn't dare touch these days, I don't think.
Yeah, there are a few. There's some language and other things. With you and Lal, like sort of early on, at least on this album, there's a sense that you like these songs that kind of keep sort of shifting, like Somewhere in Hollywood. I mean, that song must have like 8 different parts and it all works together. And I think I mentioned that, you know, I'd sort of come back to that song and I was like, wait, there's just so much going on in the song. I mean, Hotel in its own way, even though it's really short, also has all these like kind of quick scene shifts. Was that something you and Lal just like to do, just kind of have different parts in these songs?
Yeah, because we were pushing each other all the time. I mean, our whole, the thing that brought us joy in the whole process was coming up with something that people hadn't heard before. We were terrible critics of our own work, and if we did something that was too drab, too normal, too obvious, we'd say, nah, let's give it a kick in the arse. It needs something here that people aren't expecting. Most people would go into a bridge or go into a chorus. Let's not do that. And that always drove us. It was to improve our abilities, if you like, and to see what might be possible. Yeah, it's interesting that you've chosen Somewhere in Hollywood. That's my favorite track from all the albums that we made, first four albums. And I made a film for it, for Graham's live version of 10cc.
I think I saw that, because you didn't want to sing it live because it's too hard, so you made a film doing it.
Oh, Jesus. Well, yeah, a lot of drop-ins on that one. Yeah, but there was another aspect to that track that was part of our mindset at the time. I mean, as you know, we came from an art school background, blah, 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 but we were beginning to sense that filmmaking might be something that we would be aiming towards, not that we've made any films, really, but we didn't have access to film equipment. We didn't have access to the time to do anything like that. All we had access to, and considerable access, was sound. So that desire sort of fed into what we were writing and recording. I mean, it's about Hollywood, that song, okay? It's a bit of a distortion, but nevertheless, it's about Hollywood and filmmaking and where all that comes from. And it was about Marilyn Monroe, I think, before Candle in the Wind was. I don't know. Some of it sounds cliched now lyrically, but nevertheless, we hoped it didn't sound cliched at the time.
No, I don't know if anyone else had sung Norman Mailer Seeks to Nail Her.
Yeah.
I think that was yours.
He's under her bed waiting for her to be dead.
No, it's another one of these like little parts of the song where it just kind of comes in, like Norman Mailer. And sorry to be singing that, but
that's all right.
Yeah, no, what happened was, you know, I'd gotten into 10cc and I was a little young for it when like those early albums came out. And so when I discovered the band a little later, I went back and picked up like Sheet Music and the first album. And, Sheet Music, it's just a wonderful sounding record too. And I kind of was drawn to sort of to kind of a lot of the fun stuff like Clockwork Creep or, you know, Wall Street Shuffle or, you know, and then later when I would come back to it as more of an adult, I'd be like, oh, Old Wild Men and Somewhere in Hollywood are these beautiful songs, and which I liked when I was younger, but when you're younger, you kind of go to the faster ones. And then later, like, no, there's like this depth on that record too. And that's, and part of that, it feels like it's sort of you discovering your voice in that stuff as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, every time I can only speak for myself really, but really I think for myself and Lal, it was about every time we sat down to write or record, it was, well, let's make this kind of better than what we'd done before or less predictable. And that was what drove us, essentially. I like Sheet Music. It's probably my favorite of the four records we made because There was still part of us that didn't know what we were doing yet. And that's, to me, that's always the best period in an artist's life. Once you know everything, you become too, there's nowhere to go in one sense.
Yeah, Graham said that was his favorite of the four, too.
Yeah. It's more exciting if you don't know what you're doing, partially. And you allow things to come out.
Was there a tension in 10cc between art and pop?
Not at that point, there wasn't. Everything, not by the time we recorded Sheet Music, everything was fine. Even into the original soundtrack, everything was fine. It was from that point, I think probably because I'm Not in Love was such a big hit, it became obvious to us, unfortunately. I tried to avoid thinking about it, but it became obvious what people expected from us. And therefore, when we were planning to go into the next record, which was How Dare You, and I may get this wrong, but I remember us having what you might call a pre-production meeting, whereby we sat around and discussed what we should be writing and recording. And the tone of the meeting was a little bit like, well, we need a one of those sort of long, weird, godly and cream ones, and we need some funny ones, and we need a love song or two. It was like suddenly that's what 10cc is all about. We've reached the point where we know what we do and we know it's successful. Let's keep on making sure that we do it and earning money. Bang, off we go. And I didn't respond well to that, and I don't think Lol did either. It was like, oh shit, we've got to repeat ourselves, do we?
The first three albums, you know, the self-titled Sheet Music and the original soundtrack, each one is so different from the one before it. The original soundtrack starts off with One Night in Paris. And yes, I'm using the English title, which, you know, is what? It's 9-minute, 3-part suite. And then you have I'm Not in Love. And then you have Blackmail, which is this, you know, rocking thing. And then side two is all, you know, these other songs, you know, none of which sound particularly like they were lifted off of any of the previous records. So, yeah, what you're describing is all of a sudden there being a sense of formula when certainly there had been no formula at all the first three records.
That's right, but and I think that's because of who we were as people. Eric and Graham were classic songwriters. Eric had grown up in a successful group since he was a young guy. And Graham had had success as a writer.
Right.
So I think formula is not quite the right word, but they knew instinctively what a good commercial song was, or what the commercial attributes of a song should be. And it was a natural part of their psyche to apply it to what they were doing. Whereas we didn't give a shit somehow. What we thrived on was, as I said before, it was the ambiguity. It was the let's come up with something that no one's heard before. And that's partially because we were fans of music and we didn't want to write something that we'd get bored with hearing ourselves.
Right.
We were our own audience, and you are when you write. You've got to please yourself first. And that's what we felt we should be continuing to do. We shouldn't be writing to other people's expectations, because we'd done pretty well doing the opposite so far. So why would we suddenly do that? And write, you know, 10 different versions of I'm Not in Love or whatever.
Yeah. I was going to say that I'm Not in Love is such a, it strikes such a great balance, because on one hand, it's, you know, this very pretty melody and it's got these, you know, kind of ironic, you know, in denial lyrics. But at the same time, the way you recorded it was so, again, something new, like with using the vocals and the faders and just the way the vocals were used and layered in that song was something that most people hadn't heard before. So it had this dreamy atmosphere that was entirely new, even if it was rooted in the structure of a pop song.
Yeah, that's true. But it was the second version of recording. First version of recording it was pretty shitty. We recorded it as a sort of a cheesy bossa nova. And It wasn't very good. Mm. It wasn't. The song's good, but we didn't frame it well, so we shelved it and carried on recording the album and came back to it later. And out of desperation, I'm sure we'd all been thinking about how to approach it, but out of desperation, I said, well, why don't we do it all with voices? Blurted it out, and it struck a chord, so we had to find a way of doing that to see if it would work. And Lol had the idea of doing it with loops. So we became a human mellotron, in a sense. And we ended up playing the desk, but instead of keys, we were using faders. But it took a while to put together, but we could feel it taking shape. And we felt probably about three quarters of the way in that this thing was actually going to work. And I remember it being a series of magical sessions. It doesn't happen very often where you're recording a piece of music and everything that you add to it really does add to it and makes a hell of a difference. It was one of those things that kept repeating itself. Every tiny thing we added was remarkable. Even the sort of jingling music boxes at the end. You know,
right.
And we didn't really know what we had until we had it, until it was finished and mixed. And we realized that we had something quite astonishing and original, but we didn't see it as a single necessarily.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you if you actually saw it as a single, or you're like, no, we'll go with Life as a Minestrone or whatever.
Yeah. And the weird thing is that the label thought it was absolutely fucking brilliant, but it was over 6 minutes long. So cowards that they were, they released Minestrone first, which was a jolly little, silly little ditty, which was like, you know, okay, guys, come on, you've got this little nugget of gold standing by. I don't know how they think, but when it did come out, it really reaped the benefits of all the work that went into it.
Yeah, and there was an AM radio edit too, because I remember hearing the full version after having heard it on, you know, like WLS or whatever in Chicago, and I was like, oh, it's longer and better this way.
It was a bastard to edit because the voices are there all the time. You know, it's find the in and find the out is tricky.
Yeah, and then One Night in Paris, which kicks off the album. How did you and Lol write that one?
Probably after smoking a lot of spliff, I imagine. I mean, it was a natural progression from something like Somewhere in Hollywood. It was longer, more involved. It was, you know.
I mean, were you like a three-part suite right when you started writing it, or did you sort of write a part and said, hey, let's do another part?
Well, Graham keeps telling me that it was like 90 minutes originally when we presented it, and I can't remember that at all. Apparently it was a lot longer than actually ended up on record, but I don't know that. We just carried on writing it and writing it. But I think it was because we were big fans of George Gershwin, big fans of Gene Kelly and those Hollywood musicals. And An American in Paris was a movie that we'd fallen in love with. And we wanted to somehow capture that mood, but in our own way. So off we went. I can't listen to it anymore because I hate the French accents that we're using. I can't stand that. But it was fun. It was a bastard to play live, obviously. Jesus. But it was us pushing the parameters of what we had achieved with Somewhere in Hollywood, if you like. It was a different kind of songwriting. It was longer. It's more involved. How far can we go before Eric and Graham tell us to shut up?
Was that early in the you know, creation of that record? Like, was that one of the first songs, or was that more toward the end, like, let's just do this, and then it became the first track?
I can't remember. I mean, there was always a period before recording where we went off and wrote, and then we brought what we had into the studio and played it to the others, and then start to record it. You know, it was very rare, and I don't remember any situation where either writing team would play to the other something and the rest went, fuck off, that's crap. We're not doing that. until much later. That did happen once. But no, it was, we gave everything and we gave everyone a chance to express what they thought their music was about, you know. That was the only way to tell if it was going to work. And we knew when something worked.
And all the singers are in the cast of that one too. You know, everyone has their own part.
Yeah.
When Bohemian Rhapsody came out, did you guys think, oh, we sort of inspired this?
Well, we were told we did, apparently. It's just that our record company weren't savvy enough to release One Night in Paris, whereas Ween's record company was savvy enough and ballsy enough to release Bohemian Rhapsody and make a difference. And boy, did it make a difference. How long was it, number one? Weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks.
Slightly shorter song, but still. So you were told that it actually was a direct influence?
Somebody said that. I can't remember who it was. It certainly wasn't Freddie, that's for sure. But we heard on the grapevine that it inspired them to write Bohemian Rhapsody, have the balls to write it.
Yeah, interesting. And and again, for the record company to release it as a single.
I forget what label they were on, but they obviously tested the water and thought, hang on, the world's ready for something like this.
Yeah, and I remember someone at some point saying, like, oh, 10cc sounds like Queen. I'm like, no, it's the other way around. Get the order right.
Yeah, and they made a video to go with it. So, boy, were they ahead of the curve.
Right, yeah, what, 76? 75. Yeah. That's That was ahead of it. So then you went back to do How Dare You. Did the songwriting teams just feel more splintered in that project?
I think we were, okay, so we'd had this massive hit. We'd been touring. We weren't a big touring band, but we were successful, you know. And I think the meeting I mentioned before was for How Dare You. But Lol and I were becoming a little bit bored with it. The predictability of the year, you know. Write, record, tour, rest, write, record, tour, rest, write, record, tour, rest, write, record, tour, record, write, blah, blah, on and on and on and on. And there was no time to stop and gather your wits when you were on to the next predictable moment. And it was wearing us a little bit. So when that meeting took place, we thought, oh, fuck it, okay. And we did our best. We wrote some good stuff for How Dare You. But it was after that point that we had a break, and we'd invented this thing called the gizmo.
Right.
Back in the days just before Hotlex, actually, a long time ago, but we hadn't managed to put it through its paces much in 10cc. We used it on things like Old Wild Man and things, right. But not. So we knew it could do that, but what else could it do? So we took some downtime at Strawberry and spent about 3 weeks there to see what it could do. And because the sort of environment was different, the attitude was different to how 10cc sessions might go, we got very excited by the process in realizing what we might be able to achieve. It was mostly sort of inspired by the sounds coming from the gizmo, and it was mostly instrumental music, if I remember correctly. And we wanted to do more. We wanted to turn it into a, you know, a sort of side project. But it was 10cc time. And it was time to start thinking about a new album, boys.
Right. And How Dare You was not the hit that original soundtrack was.
It did okay, I think, but the world was changing. What year was that?
76.
Okay, well, the world was about to change, if it hadn't already. There was new blood out there, and it was a different kind of blood. It wasn't blue blood anymore. It was different.
I mean, it didn't have the kind of smash that I'm Not in Love was. Like, I'm Andy Fly Me was. No. I mean, there were some great songs on it, but it wasn't that level.
No, that's right. That's correct. And so Lol and I have been enjoying ourselves, pushing ourselves in a different direction. We wanted to be given a little bit more time to finish what we were st- starting. But as I said, that you know, it was time, contract-wise, to make another 10cc record. So I remember we went to some big bash in London. I think Paul McCartney had recently bought the Buddy Holly catalogue or something. I had a bash in London, and we all went there, and we had a jolly old time and got very drunk and stoned. And we came back to Strawberry because Eric and Graham wanted to play us a song that they'd written for the next album. And so we all piled in, and then they played us this song, and I could feel my stomach clenching and my heart dropping. I don't know what the song was.
I think it was People in Love.
Exactly what it was. I keep thinking it's The Things We Do for Love, but it was love. There was love all over it, except from me and Law. And it was, it just, because we were so up on what we were doing, this sounded like everything that we felt we shouldn't be doing. It was like, it sounded lame, it sounded ordinary, it predictable, everything that we didn't think we should be doing. And we said so. Not pleasant.
And this is right after this party.
Right after this party.
Okay.
I think. But we didn't, you know, we have to be honest, we couldn't say it's great, guys. We'd love to do that. Can't wait to get stuck in. It was, we didn't think it was exciting. It wasn't stimulating. It was a sort of, I'm not in love part two, you know, or it's another love song. And we were thinking, what the hell is this? So that feeling developed over the next few weeks or so. We wanted to get back to what we were doing. The thought being, you know, come on, guys, give us a bit more time. Give us a break to learn something new. Get this out of our systems. We'll learn something and bring it back to the table, and then we can start a new 10cc album. That was our way of thinking. But we weren't allowed to do that somehow. It was I don't know, maybe it's a very Manchester thing, maybe a northern thing, all for one and one for all, lads. You're either in this or you're out kind of situation. And that's pretty much what it came down to. It's time to make a record, lads. But we're not ready. Well then, you know, get ready or fuck off.
So were you given like an ultimatum, like do Consequences, the Schizmo Project, or do
I think the next we gave ourselves record? We gave ourselves the ultimatum, ultimately. Because there came a point where we realized that, okay, we believe in what we're doing, right or wrong. And that element would be missing if we went into this thinking the way we do, and this being a new 10cc album starting with this song. It just felt like we'd run out of steam. So we just bailed. We had to. Silly in retrospect, but you know.
That's it for episode 177 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Kevin Godley for taking us inside the workings of one of the smartest, most creative bands ever, 10cc. In February, he and Graham Gouldman released their first new song in two decades, Don't Want to Go to Heaven, under the moniker GG25. You can check out a cool video of them performing it with a string section on YouTube. And if you go to kevin-godley.com, you can learn more about him and download the six songs that he and Gouldman wrote and recorded together for their 2006 EP, GG06. Godley's first solo album, Muscle Memory, came out in 2020 and can now be streamed on digital sites. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who knows how to make old wild men sound good. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And you have $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for part two of this excellent conversation with Kevin Godley. Thanks.